Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hey folks, Brian Salvatore here, host of Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. We had promised that this week was going to be a week of switcheroos. We were going to have different hosts on different shows, and we are not abandoning that idea. We're just postponing it a bit because this week we had a number of conflicts that could not be resolved. So next week you'll be having all the wacky shows with different hosts everywhere. This week is a fairly standard week of Amazing Avenue Audio, which is to say, still a really fun week. So enjoy all these shows and tune in next week for the zaniness. Thanks.
Everyone, and welcome one more time to Unformidable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded Mets in our beloved franchise's quirky, ever-adventurous history, as every player who dons the orange and blue is, in their own way, unformidable to all of us Met fans. So it is All-Star week, partial week, whatever, getting ready to watch Polar Bear Pete go into the home run contest, home run derby. I can't believe there's an actual Met who I almost expect or think has a legitimate chance to win the home run derby. That is quite unprecedented. I know David Wright had that wonderful run in 2006, but never really thought of him as the home run derby champ type. And frankly, I don't really give much of a crap about the home run derby, so I don't even know why I'm going off on this digression. But it's the only baseball we have today, so let's go, Pete. Now, maybe you'd think that All-Star and less heralded, as is the raison d'être of this podcast, are essentially oxymorons, but lest we forget, every team is required to have an All-Star representative each year, and these are the oft-flailing, often, too often, no-star New York Mets. Yeah, I was going through the Mets' history of All-Star selections, and you know, some years, even if the player was less than a clear-cut All-Star, the name is incredibly familiar. I thought probably too familiar for a podcast such as this. For a recent example, Daniel Murphy was the Mets' lone All-Star in 2014. He had a good year, but probably wouldn't have made it that year, I don't think, if the Mets didn't need to have a representative. And if you look at basically every pre-Seaver season from 62 to 66, Ron Hunt aside, apologies to Ron Hunt, who, you know, is a deserving All-Star in 64 and 66. You have Richie Ashburn in 1962, Duke Snyder in 1963, Ed Cranepool in 1965. Lovely player, fine players, well, particularly the first two, had numerous legitimate All-Star berths, but probably didn't deserve it in 62 or 63. Certainly Ed Cranepool. All felt like kind of token representatives, but again, players who are well-known in baseball history, or perhaps in Ed Cranepool's case, more so in Mets history. But looking at the 1977 to 1983 years, often considered one of the darkest periods in Mets history, boy, that's saying something, isn't it? The Mets sent more than one representative to the All-Star game only once in those six, seven, however many years that period is. Seven, right? Sent more than one representative only once in 1979 when Lee Mazzilli made his only All-Star appearance and joined four-time All-Star John Stearns and got robbed of the All-Star game MVP in the first All-Star game I vaguely remember. But I digress. Lee Maz, of course, was the face of the moribund franchise then, but actually wasn't my favorite player as a very young kid. I went to my first game in 1979. My cousins all were in love with Lee Mazzilli, and I think I just had to be a little different. So I remember taking as a liking to my first favorite Met, another outfielder, frankly had an even better 1979 than the matinee idol Maz, but someone who made a, you know, with Maz and Stearns, another player who made a really stupid five-year-old think that good times for the Mets might just be around the corner, and that is Joel Youngblood. Joel Youngblood was drafted in the second round of the draft in 1970 by the Cincinnati Reds, and actually made his MLB debut on a team that is often placed in the conversation as one of the greatest of all time, the 1976 Cincinnati Red Big Red Machine team. He was a pinch hitter and defensive replacement, appearing in 55 games, garnering only 60 at-bats, batting 193. And he actually made his only career appearance at catcher, which is interesting because Youngblood was kind of a precursor to the super subs in certain ways, where he really played all around the diamond. I tried to do a ton of research on this, and I could not figure out if Joel Youngblood was on the Reds postseason roster and has a World Series ring. If someone knows that, I'd love to know. The Reds swept through that postseason, sweeping the Phillies in the LCS in 3, the Yankees in the World Series in 4, and frankly rarely used their bench players. I mean, I guess it's a note of how dominant that team was. If he was on the roster, he did not appear in the postseason. Anyway, perhaps not seeing a spot for Youngblood in the George Foster, Cesar Geronimo, Ken Griffey Sr. outfield, the back-to-back defending champions traded him just prior to the start of the 1977 season for pitching prospect Bill Claudel. The 25-year-old Youngblood spent all of 25 games there in St. Louis before the Cardinals traded him to the Mets on June 15th, 1977, for Mike Phillips. The trade for Joel Youngblood might have gone a little bit under the radar that day, as you might be aware of a couple of other more notable moves the Mets made that day, trading slugger Dave Kingman and, oh, by the way, franchise icon Tom Seaver in what is more commonly known as the Midnight Massacre. Unlike the horrific Seaver trade and the kind of non-eventful, not useful Kingman trade, the Joel Youngblood trade was one that would actually work out kind of decently for the Mets, as Youngblood took his place on the Mets active roster, and player manager Joe Torre retired for Youngblood's place to open up the place on the roster for Youngblood, becoming just manager. And Youngblood would go on to spend several solid years with the organization, making that one aforementioned All-Star appearance in 1981, not 1979, when he probably had his best season. And if we'll discuss that, and of course we'll also discuss the most notable, well, maybe footnotable might be more appropriate, but hey, I have a baseball card commemorating it. The most memorable but cool baseball event of Joel Youngblood's life, which of course is tied to his departure from the New York Mets. But before we get to that, let's just look at his beginnings with the Mets when Youngblood was basically a part-time player in 77 and 78. He appeared in 70 games and got 182 at-bats after the trade in 77, 113 games and 266 at-bats in 78, primarily splitting time between second, third, and the outfield. Wow, the Mets playing someone around the diamond. How odd. He was definitely at his best in the outfield. He had what Bob Murphy described as a howitzer for an arm. His defensive numbers as an outfielder were excellent. The defensive metrics for him as an infielder are much less kind. But in 1979, his age 27 season, that fabled best season for many players, which it really was for Youngblood, he was a regular, still appearing sporadically in the infield, but mostly in left and right field, where he recorded 18 assists in 1979, 18 outfield assists, excuse me, and that's a number he would actually equal in 1980, and that's not even being a complete 150 games in the outfield kind of guy. You know, he as I said, he'd get 10, 15 games a year at second and third, filling in for injured players and so forth, or just filling the Mets' omnipresent hole at third base. Didn't look like Youngblood would be a regular in 79. I get the impression the Mets always viewed him in that super sub kind of role. I mean, nowadays, I think the Zobristian has replaced Super Sub and it has made people appear more valuable. But at that time, I think it was looked at as more of a detriment or, you know, more of a pejorative for the player's career. But when Elliot Maddox got hurt early in the 79 season, Youngblood kind of got an opportunity and ran with it. As a regular right fielder, he slugged 482, which, you know, I think pretty good in 79, from April 15th through July 31st. And as I said, is far and away his best season. He put up a 4.5 WAR that season, an OPS plus of 117. And 79 is kind of the first season I vaguely remember watching baseball in the Mets, so, you know, perhaps that's why he became one of my favorite players. But he got in 158 games, which is great for a quote-unquote super sub, hit 16 home runs, which was one off his career high. He did have a career high of 60 RBIs and 18 stolen bases against 13 caught stealings, but hey, people didn't care about, you know, 80% success rate back in the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, he put up a 4.5 WAR according to Baseball Reference that season, perhaps buoyed by his outfield defense, and actually tied the Mets single season record at the 37 doubles in 1979. And in one very personal note, for 1979, he appeared in the very first Met game I ever attended on September 23rd, 1979, a 7-4 defeat in 10 innings against the Cardinals, where he went 1-for-4 playing in center field and left field. And his successor, as my favorite Met, one Keith Hernandez, would go 0-for-3 with a walk and a sacrifice fly on his way to a co-MVP award that fine baseball season.
What's up, baseball fans? There's nothing better than being there. The stadium, the snacks, that loud crack of the bat on the ball. But sometimes getting those tickets feels like a real struggle. I mean, are ticketing websites making it this hard on purpose? Imagine what it would be like if those sites actually cared about getting you that perfect seat. With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek does just that. The app pulls together tickets from all over the web, rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, and then shows you the view from your seat. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you're not going to show up and then not see the game. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, the SeatGeek app is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. Go give it a shot today, and SeatGeek will give you $10 off your first purchase when you use promo code SBNation. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code SBNation for $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code SBNation.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Youngblood followed up 79 with another solid year in 1980. He only hit 8 home runs and recorded a slightly above average 104 OPS plus, but 2.5 B WAR. Again, his outfield defense rated well by the advanced metrics I looked up, and he had his 18 outfield assists once again. But he did still move around some, and in 1981, before the season, he informed Still manager Torrey that he would like to play strictly in the outfield, that he was tired of the quote-unquote super sub label and yearned for something more. And Joel Youngblood would, in fact, be an all-star, the Mets' only all-star, in 1981. Never a huge batting average guy, Youngblood was actually leading the league in batting, I think at .350. In 1981, before injuring his left knee sliding into third base on June 6th in Houston in the Astrodome. Youngblood was expected to miss 2 to 3 weeks, but he wouldn't play again until August 9th, because no one would play again until between June 12th and August 9th, thanks to a massive baseball work stoppage. So the 81 season resumed on August 9th with the All-Star Game, and Youngblood, then healthy and leading the league in hitting at the time, was the Mets' sole All-Star representative, and it was his only All-Star appearance in his career. In the second inning, he pinch hit for Fernando Valenzuela in the bottom of the second and fouled out against AL All-Star starter and undeserving Hall of Famer Jack Morris in an All-Star game in which future Met Gary Carter would be named the MVP with two home runs. Youngblood appeared in only five more games before re-injuring his knee on August 14th and would wind up missing the remainder of the season. He finished that season with a .350 average, and actually his best slash line, .398 on base percentage, .531 slugging, .929 OPS, .165 OPS plus, incredible numbers for a career .265 hitter. And he had he had enough plate appearances, he would have led the league in batting. Bill Madlock led the NL that year with a .341 batting average. And that would lead us to 1982, which would be Jill Youngblood's last season with the Mets. The Mets acquired George Foster in 82, and a young center fielder named Mookie Wilson was developing nicely. So there didn't seem to be room for Youngblood to become the regular outfielder that he aspired to be. The Mets actually started 82 pretty well by early 80s Mets standards. They at the June 15th standard trade deadline, they were only 5.5 games behind the Cardinals, but by early August, the Mets had fallen to fifth place, 13.5 games off the pace, and they found themselves in Chicago at Wrigley Field in early August in what would be Jill Youngblood's last day as a Met and the day he would make baseball history. August 4th, 1982. Craig Swan, slated to take the hill for the Mets against future Hall of Famer Ferguson Jenkins. Trade rumors were swirling about Jill Youngblood. Frank Cashin said, "We had hoped to make the deal by game time, but there was a phone circuit problem. We couldn't complete it." Manager George Bamberger, oh God, I hated him, asked me what to do with Youngblood. I told him to go ahead and start him. We'd take a chance on his getting hurt. Some things never change in this organization. Fascinating. Anyway, the Mets were down 1-0 early, but the Mets scored three runs in the third inning. Lots of great names, at least by my standards here. So Bob Baylor singled, Craig Swan, helping his own cause, got a base hit himself to put runners on first and second. Leadoff hitter Wally Backman followed with a double, put RBI double. Craig Swan was on third, Backman on second. John Stearns walked. Loading the bases, bringing up Jill Youngblood, who came through with a single to plate two runs, give the Mets a 3-1 lead in a game they would win. Youngblood played the field in the bottom of the third, but when he came in after that inning, he found out that he had been traded to the Montreal Expos in mid-game. In the bottom of the fourth inning, Mookie Wilson came out to replace Youngblood in center, and Jill Youngblood was packing up his stuff and getting a cab to go to the airport to go to Philadelphia and Veterans Stadium, where the Expos were slated to play the Phillies that night. Of course, the Mets were involved in the classic Wrigley day game, since there were no lights at that point in time. In fact, according to Youngblood, he made the plane reservation, went to the hotel to pack, realized he left his glove in the Mets dugout, went back to the ballpark to get it, went to the airport, had dinner on the plane, and took a cab to Veterans Stadium. He wanted to rush there. He wanted to get to the Expos, who were kind of hanging on at the fringes of the pennant race behind the Phillies, who they were playing that night, and the Cardinals. When he got to Veterans Stadium, the game was already underway, and the efficient, apparently very efficient, Montreal Expos had his new uniform waiting for him with his name stitched on the back. The Expos manager, Jim Fanning, met Youngblood in the dugout and promptly sent him to right field in the sixth inning as a defensive replacement for Jerry White. Youngblood came up in the next inning and slapped a single in his only plate appearance against another future Hall of Famer, Steve Carlton, giving Youngblood two hits for two different teams on the same calendar day, the first and only time that ever happened in baseball history. And there were so few Met accomplishments or half-Met accomplishments in my early life between 79 and 1982, you bet I cherished the baseball card celebrating that feat of Jill Youngblood's when it came out the following year. And of course, it's a nice little cherry on top of the sundae that he got both of those hits against future Hall of Famers, although apparently not as surprising. In the latter case, Youngblood was actually 27 for 82 with 5 home runs off his career in Steve Carlton. So it was actually a favorable matchup for him against lefty. But with that abrupt and dramatic end to his Met career, Youngblood wrapped up his Met career as a 274 hitter, 333 on-base percentage, 410 slugging, so 742 OPS, 108 OPS plus. He appeared in 610 games as a Met and had 1,897 at-bats as a member of the New York Metropolitan. Youngblood wouldn't help the Expos much, hitting an even 200. He got 90 at-bats and 18 hits, but he did get a hit in his first at-bat as an Expo, and as noted, it was historic. Youngblood was a free agent after that 82 season, which was one of the reasons the Mets had him on the trade block. They had given him a 3-year, $300,000 contract in 1980, and they had no intention of re-signing him. Go figure. He signed with the San Francisco Giants after the 82 season, where he spent the bulk of his career from 83 to 88. He had a couple of really good offensive years for the Giants in 83 and 84. He hit a career-high 17 homers in 83. However, the Giants used him primarily at second and third base, where he struggled mightily, which really brought down his advanced stats and metrics. So he did pretty well for them offensively, but he was definitely a much better outfielder than infielder, according to the numbers. I actually ran into Joel Youngblood not long ago at all. He was at Citi Field signing autographs before a Friday game against the Tigers in May. Him and Doug Flynn, be another great, unformidable Met. And I mentioned that he was like my favorite player as a kid, and sad he left, and he claimed he thought of coming back in 83 as a free agent, but he thought he had a better chance at playing time with the Giants. I kind of found that hard to believe since the Mets were so bad, but I mean, he did struggle for playing time with the Mets, so I guess he didn't want to go back into that scenario again. But thus ended his career with the Mets. He spent 83 to 88 with the Giants, and he kind of came full circle, signing with the Cincinnati Reds in 1989 and finishing his career as he started it as a bench player for the Cincinnati Reds. Overall, according to Baseball Reference, Youngblood recorded 10.6 career WAR, and 9.3 of that came with the Mets. So, you know, obviously had his best, most memorable years with the Mets. One of the players in his Baseball Reference similarity scores, he's noted a couple of times, is Gabe Kapler. And one other note, Youngblood coached, never managed in the majors as of yet. I will say that having met him and seen him signing autographs, man is jacked. Joel Youngblood is still in very good shape, so he also shares that in common with Gabe Kapler, in case you're wondering. At any rate, his post-baseball life, like many players, Youngblood did go into coaching, coached with the Reds, Brewers and Orioles organizations, and managed an Orioles farm club in 1992. He left baseball for a bit and returned to coaching with the Arizona Diamondbacks in 2007. He has served as a minor league outfield and base running coordinator and was also their third base coach for part of the 2010 season, which I'm very sad that I don't remember. Maybe the Mets, I guess I missed that, or I would have been absolutely delighted. And obviously he's still, had his best years with the Mets, and he still seems to appear at Met promotional events like he did in May when I saw him there. But Joel Youngblood, All-Star in 1981, actually in Cleveland, if I remember. I believe it was in Cleveland Memorial Stadium or whatever that old place was called where I think that All-Star game was. All-Star in 81, baseball history by slapping a base hit for two different teams in one day in 1982, and an unformidable New York Met. Certainly for me, and hopefully for all of us. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to Unformidable. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. Follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave a review. It really helps us out. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Tonight, let's go Pete. Tomorrow, let's go NL. And always, let's go Mets. We'll be right back.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hey, it's Charlie Harding from Switched on Pop, the podcast about the making and meaning of popular music. And this week, we get into K-pop. It is a thing that I just haven't known how to wrap my head around, but the music is everywhere. And it is now a global phenomenon. It is a part of the US pop market. It is charting on the Billboard. It's playing on SNL. And this week, we talk about BTS and Halsey's Boy With Love, talk to some K-pop experts, and really get to the bottom of how ought we listen to K-pop as a music, as a genre, and as a multimedia phenomenon. Check it out on Switched on Pop, anywhere you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every Tuesday.